Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to Women's Wednesday here on Mind Talk. Every Wednesday, you and I have the opportunity to meet a woman who's agreed to share her story with us. Today's guest is a very busy person. She is an author, a speaker, a mental health counselor, and almost a doctor, Trillian Small. Welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Pamela. It's so great to be here, and it's such an honor just to be able to be here and encourage the awesome men and women that are tuning in today.
Well, Trillian, in 2016, I mean, you're kind of awesome in your own right. 2016, you were recognized as one of Nashville's top 40 under 40.
Yes, ma'am.
Not bad.
Yeah, and it's awesome, too, because when I was honored, I was 28. So that's definitely tremendous to be able to be recognized with those who are under the age of 40. And so that was a true blessing for me.
Absolutely. You are also, which is what we're going to be talking to you about today, the author of The Caged in Heart, How Your Childhood Wounds Are Affecting Your Adult Life. Now, in addition to the information that I've always shared with the audience, you are a certified John Maxwell speaker, trainer, and coach. What does that mean?
Yes, ma'am. So John Maxwell essentially is a leadership and business development guru. He's written several books, over 100 books. He has traveled, I believe, just about every continent of the world, training leaders and training businesses how to really develop and grow and to influence the community at large. And so essentially joining along Don Maxwell just basically means you have the amazing privilege of using his curriculum to go out and do the exact same thing that he is doing and teaching leaders and developing leaders and businesses to really grow and take their business to the next level. The reason why I did that is I'm very future focused, and so I like to follow those who are already doing what I want to do. And I say, wow, John Maxwell is an international leader. He's written multiple books, more than I can probably even imagine of writing. And I say, wow, that's the leader that I want to follow, because his example is what I actually want to emulate in my own practice, in my own life. And so, yeah, that's what it means just to be a John Maxwell certified speaker, trainer, and coach.
You know, what's interesting as I hear you talk about it is your dedication and your commitment to moving forward, but also the energy and the excitement that you have about the things that you're doing.
Yes, ma'am. One of the things that I love telling people when I do speak about what I do, one of the main things I love saying is I am a mental health counselor, and I tell people that's not a career for me. That's actually a calling for myself, and that's actually my life. I turned to counseling because I recognized, one, that I had a deep need for it. I had a deep need for internal healing, and I saw the benefit that it had on my life, and I thought, wow, like, other people really, truly do need this. And so, yes, ma'am, I love what I do, and I'm always focused on anything that I do, whether it's writing books, whether it's speaking, training, or counseling. I always say my two main focuses are the person's heart and the person's mindset. I feel like those are the two main areas that if we can just get those two to align properly, we will see unlimited number amount of opportunities and success in every area of our lives.
Let's start with your childhood. I want to go back there because, again, the person with whom I am speaking today is energetic, accomplished, thoughtful, really guided in a path that works for you. I'd like to ask, what was your childhood like? Were there things in your childhood that impacted the person you are today?
Truly, and it's always a blessing to just share that story, because when people look at my life now, they say, that doesn't really line up with your past story. I think that's just the beauty of God's hand on my life. So growing up, my father was an alcoholic. He was a military. He's an alcoholic. He was very abusive. None to my knowledge of him physically abusing myself, but I do recall him often physically abusing my mother as well as my older brother. And so that was the environment I lived in. And so just as early on, I really, and it's so interesting that I'm, you know, I'm now helping others come out of their emotions because early on as a child, I didn't know how to do that. Because of course, when you grow up in a domestic violence situation, even if it's not yourself, if it's the person that's in your family and you're experiencing that, you kind of grow to develop a kind of a callus around your heart. You know, you don't know how to express your emotions. And if you do express your emotions, you might get lashed back out about those things. And so I witnessed that early on in life. And then, of course, my mother, she made the awesome and bold move to decide to pack us up and leave. And so they did get a divorce early on in life. And so I did grow up with a single mother until she got remarried. And so that's essentially how my childhood was. And that definitely did affect every single relationship that I had. And I didn't recognize that, honestly, until a few years ago, that my past was actually still affecting me. But it's a beautiful thing because I have that experience really taught me how to be very resilient. And I learned how to go within myself to find peace, because I didn't have peace in my exterior, in my outer world. And so the only place that I could go was inside. And lo and behold, that even wasn't as peaceful as I thought it was until I started going to counseling. But that was the only place, the only safe place that I could go was within myself.
Well, you know, certainly growing up in a household in which there is domestic violence, whether you are physically hit or not, you too are a victim of it. And as you said, right, you learn to be still because that's typically the only way to survive.
Right. And I minimized that for so long. I thought, well, it wasn't me, it was just my mom. And, you know, he didn't hit me, so I should be okay. Why am I making this a big deal? Until I started to, practice in my PhD and really study research, and even found that, wow, those who have experienced domestic violence, who have witnessed domestic violence, are just as affected as if they were the ones that were hit.
Absolutely. And sometimes with those folks, with folks who have witnessed it but not physically experienced it, there can be some guilt, if you will, or unwillingness to acknowledge that, yes, indeed, they too were affected. It's almost as though they don't have a right to feel how they feel. Did you ever experience that?
Yes, all the way up until my early 20s, I felt that way. I felt, Trillion, you were not the one cowering in a corner. So why are you trying to make this big deal out of I'm hurt and that's why I don't trust men? And so in my mindset, it really was, I feel horrible for wanting to say that affected me because I wasn't it. But until I finally recognized witnessing it was just as traumatic. It's called secondary trauma. It's called vicarious trauma. You experience someone else's trauma by watching it or by hearing about it. But it took for me the ability to sit down and say, that mattered to me and I'm not okay. That was the toughest thing for myself, to be able to say, I am not okay. And once I gave myself the permission to say I'm not okay, I began to, that's when the healing process began to begin. When I said, I'm not okay. And I was okay with saying I'm not okay because of what happened to me.
You're not okay. And it's okay to say you're not okay is,
yes,
such an important breakthrough. And for those listening who have been in chaotic households, my true hope is that if they take nothing else away from our conversation today, it is that they too were victimized, an awareness that they too were victimized, even if a hand was not laid on them.
Right.
Now, in the Caged in Heart, the subtitle to this is How Your Childhood Wounds Are Affecting Your Adult Life. Let's start with, because clearly you talk about trauma in the book because that's what you experience. Give us your definition of trauma. What does that mean?
So the way that I view trauma is anything that has happened to you that has caused you to change the way that you view yourself or view your others. Now, people might say, well, that can be anything. Well, I mean, honestly, to me, I believe that trauma is subjective. And so what one person says is traumatic, another person might say, oh, that didn't bother me. And so that's why, again, going back to not minimizing what you experience, it can even go down to being unintentionally traumatized. And I hear this often with parents of, I didn't know that bothered you. I didn't know that affected you. Of course, there are no perfect people. There are no perfect parents. And we had this beautiful conversation with my mom. And that we actually didn't have that conversation or this whole conversation about our past and how it affected us until I published this book. And my mom said, I did not know that those things affected you. Of course, because I wasn't the victim directly. I wasn't the victim. And so it's even unintentionally, we can experience trauma.
And, you know, the notion of learning to be silent as a survival mechanism is something that I think many people can relate to. And even if there is not an awareness that that grows out of trauma, if you're a person who has learned to be silent, it's really useful to take a look at how you learned that. What was the benefit of that for you? Because clearly there was a benefit, although it may not have been a good quote-unquote benefit, it was a survival benefit.
Oh, right. And I love how you say that. It's a survival mechanism. It's what kept them alive in that circumstance. And so as we grow and develop, we recognize that what kept you alive then is now hurting you now. And so it's now turned maladaptive coping, whereas before it was healthy for you to be silent because you didn't get hurt. But now as you grow and you develop as an adult and somebody asks your opinion or something is happening to you and you have that system in your mind of just be silent, just don't say anything. Well, now that's actually hurting you. And so that's one of the things I like to help individuals do as well is rediscovering their voice, rediscovering their story and recognizing you don't have to be silent about experiencing domestic violence. You don't have to be silent about experiencing abuse. And I think there is in a culture, I don't want to just say African-American culture, because I've seen it in several different cultures, but it's just one of those stigmas behind just don't air your dirty laundry. Just don't talk about it. It's almost as if we really believe that the elephant in the room does not exist if we don't look at it. But that is so not true. It's actually more harmful to not address the elephant in the room, who I say is probably sitting on your chest, and which is causing you to not want to speak up because you have this sense of suffocation. But it's addressing that elephant in the room and recognizing this elephant in the room is going to squish us all eventually if we don't talk about it.
And, you know, the reality is that the energy that it actually takes, I mean, the sort of psychic and emotional and physical energy it takes to not see what you actually see can be pretty amazing. And a lot of folks don't think about it in that way. You know, I also want to comment on the fact that your mom gathered her resources and left and divorced. Because as we know, in domestic violence situations, often when the abused person chooses to leave, their life is in at least as much danger as it is when they stay.
Right. I know my mother said she planned for like a year. So she planned the escape for like a year of the finances and where we're going to go and making sure he wasn't going to be at home when we were packing and when we left. And so she did a great job of keeping me away from that information. And if our lives were threatened after we moved, I'm not really sure about that. But I do know, and none to my knowledge, and none that I've experienced, but I do know that she experienced abuse for many, many years. I was the youngest of four. My brother, I was the youngest of four, and I was four or five at the time. And my oldest brother was, I believe, 15 or so. And so she had experienced, she had been in that relationship for many, many years before she finally, and that's what she said. She said the defining moment for her was when he put his hands on her child. And that's when she recognized, okay, it's gone too far now. And for one, it went too far when he laid his hands on her. But then when it started to bring in the children, that's when she decided, I have to do something because now my children are in danger.
And, you know, that's such a I don't want to say common, but it's not at all rare for a victim of abuse to, you know, tolerate it as best he or she can. But when someone or something that person really cares about is harmed, that does give them the energy and sort of the eyes wide open ability to begin to make change. And the fact that your mom planned this for a year is really pretty amazing. Sounds like she's quite the woman.
She is an amazing woman. I just learned so much from her. I learned the power of strength and endurance, and I believe that's where I got some of my resilience from. There's nothing that can hold me down. If I put my head down and I just run full force ahead, I can accomplish whatever I want. And she taught me that no matter what she was going through, she taught me there is nothing that you cannot do. And so I definitely value for her for that. And she has continued to be a tremendous encouragement for me.
It really sounds like a wonderful relationship. And again, a wonderful human being. And in so many ways, she saved the lives of her children as well as herself by leaving.
Mm-hmm. Right. And she did. And so for so long, going back to the guilt, I wrestled with that because that was a great decision. She did what was right. And then it took me to but I still am hurting because I don't have that void filled of, am I loved by my father? Now, so it's, and I see this so many times with children or adults wrestling with, but he was a bad man. But I still, for some reason, feel like I need that void filled. And so, like, how do you deal with it? How do you deal with needing someone who is abusive to fill that void? And honestly, I published this book before I even, so my father, my biological father, the man that my mother was married to, he reached out to me 2 years ago. So this was after I published this book, but I didn't respond to him because I had all those mixed emotions.
Sure.
Of course, I was aligned with my mom of, no, I can't talk to you because of what you did to her. And what is she going to think about? How is she going to feel? So I just wrestled with so much. And I finally responded. And so this is the thing. I finally responded because God began to minister to my heart about this man. And God recognized that reconciliation, whatever that looks like, was necessary, and forgiveness was necessary before I could move forward in my life. And so I published this book, The Caged In Heart, before I reconciled with my father. And so I'm going to have to write another book to really bring in some of those components as well, because it's really difficult. But he came back into my life. He reached back out to me on Facebook, and I didn't want to respond, but I did, and I expressed to him some of my anger, some of my sadness, and all of that. It took me 2 years to actually give him a call because I hadn't forgiven him. Now, I would say with my mouth, I forgive him, but God says, you do not forgive him. You haven't forgiven him because the moment you think about him, you get angry. And God said, that's not forgiveness. And so God took me on this whole 2-year journey. I think I was probably delaying it more so than God was, because I didn't want to. I felt justified in my anger towards him. I felt, God, I don't have to forgive this man. This is me, Christian, I know. I don't have to forgive this man because he was abusive. And why do I have, as the child, have to forgive someone who did my family wrong? And
you know,
God clearly said, go ahead.
Trillian, we're going to take a break, but when we come back, you know, I'd like for you to talk a little bit on the matter of forgiveness and the value it has to the self, because clearly what you're talking about is something that so many people struggle with. Folks, you are listening to Trillian Small, author of The Caged in Heart, How Your Childhood Wounds Are Affecting Your Adult Life. We'll be back in just a moment. generally, and for many people, when they experience life-altering harm, the last thing that they think about is forgiving the person who has created or conducted the harmful event or events, whatever they are. And the idea of forgiveness is something that is so foreign. Can you speak to the value of forgiveness for yourself, for individuals in general?
Right. So forgiveness, and I'm sure many of us have heard this before, but forgiveness is not for the other person. It's for us. It's like us drinking poison and then waiting for that person to die. Unforgiveness is like that. And I, for so long, thought, because I verbally spoke, oh, I forgive my dad. Oh, I'm just going to, you know, forgive him and I'm going to move on. But any time that I thought about him, a sense of resentment and bitterness and anger came up. And recently, about 2 years ago, when my father came back into my life, I resisted even reaching out. For one, my mindset was, I'm doing well now in my life, and I did well without you, and I'm too old now for daddy. So you're a day late, a dollar short. And so I didn't want to forgive him because I felt that he didn't deserve to be in my life. And it took a long time. But over the course of God bringing different people in my life week after week, it really felt like it was a domino effect of God really trying to get me to see that I have not forgiven my father. And God clearly said to me one day that if you don't forgive your father, you are hindering yourself and you're preventing or delaying me from taking you into your promised land. Because I can't take you into your promised land with this hard heart and unforgiveness that you have for your dad. He even took it a step further and said, I can't bring you your husband until you forgive your dad. And of course, I'm, you know, a single woman, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe you. So I'm now, you know, a little upset with God, like, that's unfair. I'm not the one that did wrong. Why am I now, quote unquote, being punished because of something that he did? And you're now asking me to basically be the bigger person here. And God was just really alluding to, I look at a person's heart. When I bless an individual, I like to look at their heart, the condition of their heart. And so when it comes to forgiveness, I know that is a really tough, tough thing. But one of those things, and one of my my women group leaders that she had really expressed to me was, for one, don't go into a marriage with daddy issues. She was already married, and she said that she did, and it was very strainful for her marriage. But then she also said what she had to do was pray for what she didn't have for her father, because she had a very similar story. And she said she simply prayed, Lord, I don't have love or compassion or mercy or forgiveness for my father. I need you to give that to me. And so I did. I prayed that, and I really didn't really feel anything. So I was like, God, okay, I guess you're going to, you know, make this forgiveness thing really work for me, because I still, when I say it, I really know that I don't feel it, because I still am angry when I think about him. And so over the course of maybe a couple of weeks went by, and it's not even that long, I started to cry because I was so upset about another relationship that I had failed in my life. And I cried out to God, and I said, God, you must help me with my emotions. They are taking over. They are controlling me, and I don't like it. And that moment, I started to pray for my future husband, and that prayer quickly shifted to me praying for my father. This is the first time I prayed for my father in such a way. I was essentially just praying, God, I love this man. I don't even know who he is. Never met him because I left when we were 4 or 5. But I love this man, and I forgive him. So I noticed a shift when I started to cry for mercy and love for this man who had hurt us. And I was driving, actually, when I was crying and praying, and I stopped at a park, and I was parked, and God said, you're now ready. And I'm like, ready for what? And he was like, you're now ready to call your dad. So 2 years ago, my dad had gave me his number on Facebook, but I never used it because I didn't want to. And God said, you have now forgiven him. Your heart is now ready to make reconciliation with this man. And so I did. I called my father, and he picked up the phone. 26 years later, first time talking to him, and just all the whole conversation was full of tears and excitement. And I didn't expect that, because you would think, you know, 26 years later, you would have a lot to say to this person.
Right.
But God had healed my heart. And it, even to this day, I still think, wow, like, how is this going to look? How, what are people going to think? But God says, it doesn't matter. This is about your destiny. And for one, this is about what you are going to help other women and other men now do. Forgiveness was so huge, and God wanting to take me and his ability to take me to the next level. I was my hindrance in my the success of my relationships, the success of my career. I even thought, what does my heart have to do with my career? Everything. And so forgiveness is not just this, I'll deal with it later. No, we must deal with forgiveness. And I understand, I was there. And so I just encourage those who are wrestling with forgiveness of whoever you are wrestling with forgiveness with, praying, God, give me a heart of love and compassion and mercy for this person. And I promise you, God will honor that, and he will help you forgive that person.
One of the challenges that folks often have with forgiveness is the sense that they're saying that what the person did was okay, and that once they forgive them, they can now forget about it and move on. And neither one of those is true. And I would suggest that the more people are aware of the fact that forgiveness does not mean you condone the behavior. And right. As you're able to experience forgiveness, it tends to take such a huge weight off of you that mm-hmm. it really can be extraordinary.
Right. And one of the things, too, about that is you're right. It's not, I'm saying what you did was okay. No, it's not. And it's also forgiveness, when you finally get to that point of forgiving, and sometimes you just forgive a person and they are deceased, and so you don't have that ability to reconcile, or you forgive that person and you have no idea where they are. You don't have contact with them. So you can still forgive that person. But in the event that you still have contact with that individual, God clearly told me, it's okay. You don't have to know the story. You don't have to know what exactly happened. Because part of us wants to, you know, I need you to justify your behavior. I need to justify why you did this. But forgiveness gives you the opportunity to start a new story. And so, yes, the past happened. No, we're not minimizing it. No, we're not saying, hey, if you come back in my life, you can do it again. What we are saying is we are healed from that, and we are now starting a new story. We're not reliving reruns of what has happened. And that's what forgiveness gives you, that opportunity and that freedom and that peace to just move forward and let go of whatever happened in the past.
So in effect, you get to take your own life back.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. I always say that parents early on are the individuals that are holding the child's pen. Children can't write until they get a certain age, but parents are the ones that are helping write that child's story. And then once we get to a certain age, that child who has turned into a teen and an adult should have that pen in their hand now. But when we have experienced abuse, sometimes that abuser is still the person that has our pen in their hand. And so forgiveness gives you that opportunity to say, hey, I think I need that pen back. Thank you very much. I'm going to now write the rest of my story the way I want to write it.
Oh, beautifully said. You talk in the Caged Heart about attachment. And, you know, the concept of attachment is all over the place these days. But many folks mm-hmm. are still not clear about what does that exactly mean. So I'm going to ask you to give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of what it actually means, this concept of attachment and the different kinds of attachment that folks can experience.
Okay, so attachment, really simple, is the connection that you have with another person. And the three needs that I address that we have in attachment are I need to be seen, I need to be heard, and I need to connect with you. I need to be seen, I need to be heard, and I need to be connected with you. And as a child, you see that with a parent and her, a parent, his and her, and their child. They hold the child. So that's the connection. I'm bonding with you. You see the child. You're looking at the child eye to eye, and you are hearing the child. So when they cry, you respond. And then on up to, you know, toddler years, mommy, look at me. I'm about to go down the slide. That means they want you to see them. When they're saying, mommy, 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 they need you to look down and say, yes, baby, what is it that you need? So you hear them. And then when you hug them and you tuck them in the bed and you take care of them, you are connecting with them. And we have those needs on up into adulthood. We need to be seen, we need to be heard, and we need to connect with other people. Whenever one of those three are wounded as a child, so whether it was physical, sexual abuse, or it could have just been mommy and daddy were working or one of them were working and they didn't have time for you. They didn't show up to your basketball game. That can be an attachment wound because you didn't see me and you didn't connect with me. You didn't take the time to connect with me. And so if one of those three are wounded, we can experience anxious attachment. So there, I'll just go over three of them. So there's anxious attachment, avoidant attachment, and secure attachment. Secure attachment is the one that we want. It's, I trust you. I love you. I know that you have my best interest in mind. I'm secure with myself. I'm okay with myself. That's the one that we want. Then we have, if one of those three, to see me or to hear me or to connect with me, or if those are hurt, we can either have anxious or avoidant attachment. So anxious attachment individuals who are very anxious in relationships, they're very clingy. They want to know where are you going, like, you know, I need your whole itinerary. You can even see this with children. When the mommy walks away, the child cries and cries and cries, and it's very difficult for someone else to console that child. And then as an adult, you can just be very anxious. You're not very trusting of individuals, and you're very suspicious. Avoidant attachment are individuals who keep you at a distance. And so avoidant attachment individuals oftentimes are okay with themselves for the most part, but they're not okay with other people coming close to them. And so that probably came about because mommy or daddy were very inconsistent. So they just learned, okay, I'm not even going to deal with people. I'm just going to keep them at arm's length, and I'm just going to stay to myself. And so those are the three, secure, avoidant, and anxious. And we can honestly have a mixture of all of them. You can be securely attached in a relationship with your mom, and then you can have a anxious attachment with a dad, and then an avoidant attachment with a loved one. We can literally have all three with different relationships. It's not just one.
So given that the different types of attachment that you're describing tend to grow out of childhood, does that mean that once you have that experience, you always have that experience?
No, not at all. If you become aware of your attachment style, you can change it. Attachment styles can change. And so it's a matter of finding at least one person who you can have a secure attachment with and learning and practicing with that person of how to trust and how to let people in, how to be vulnerable with one person. I personally was a mixture of anxious and avoidant, primarily avoidant because I just didn't want people to get close. I was that way for very, very, very many years until I met my supervisor, my counseling supervisor, who really taught me it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to let me know that you don't have everything together. It's okay to not be perfect with me. And so she taught me I could show my heart to somebody and it not get stomped on, metaphorically speaking. And from that experience, I borrowed, we call it borrowed attachment. So I borrowed my secure attachment from her, and I then was able to apply it to other relationships with some discernment. So, of course, there are some relationships where you can't just give your heart to everyone. So you have to just discern, are you a person that's healthy for me or not? And if they're not, just say, okay, I'm not giving you my heart. But we can, if we didn't grow up with a secure attachment, we can definitely borrow a secure attachment and then apply it to other areas, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. You just used a term of discernment in terms of dealing with relationships. How does one engage in, learn how to feel comfortable with this notion of relational discernment, being able to choose who's an okay person to let in and who perhaps is not?
Right. And so honestly, that's a matter of one, recognizing and learning yourself, because the more that you understand and know about yourself, the more you're able to appropriately connect with another person. And so if you are anxiously attached, even if you are discerning that this person is not good for you, if they are giving you attention, you are going to cling to them because of the attention, even if they are unhealthy for you. And so relational discernment essentially is recognizing, I'm going to see this person for who they are. I am going to trust my feelings to a certain extent. And if that gut feeling, I forget who said this, but it's when a person shows you who they are, believe them. that's how discernment is. It's, if you are showing me over and over again that you are inconsistent and unreliable, then I'm going to discern that you're probably not the best person for me to be in a continual relationship with. And if they are proving to you that, hey, I am consistent and I am reliable, then okay, great. Then maybe we can build some sort of relationship. But honestly, individuals who are more anxious, I call it in the book relational hypervigilance.
Yes. And
so hypervigilance is an individual who is overly sensitive to perceived threat or actual threat. And of course, scripture tells us to be vigilant and be watchful. But hypervigilant is when you go overboard and you're seeing too far into something. So if a person doesn't text you back right away, a hypervigilant person would say, oh, you're just ignoring me. It's like, well, no, I was just in a meeting at work and I couldn't get back to you right away. And so when you shift from hypervigilant, relational hypervigilance, to relational discernment, you are still taking that watchfulness of watching a person's behavior, but you're not jumping the gun. You're not being as impulsive. It's taking what, and I love, one time I was at the YMCA watching, I'm a people watcher, and so I was watching the lifeguard, and they were just scanning the pool back and forth, and I was wondering, like, they have to be very, very vigilant to watch this pool, and it wasn't that many of them, so I did my whole study of, well, how do lifeguards do this? How do they watch their pool? And they just scan for a break in the flow. That was one of the things that I read on Google. Lifeguards scan for a break. So if you're splashing and you're having fun, that's not a break in the flow. But if a head is bobbing down and it's bobbing up and the hands are flaring and they're gasping for air, that's a break in the flow. So if a person wants to really become more discerning, I say look for a break in the flow of the spirit. When you have that gut feeling of something's not right, that's a break in the flow of the spirit. Now, obviously, you can't watch everything, but you're just looking for that one break in the flow, or those one or two things that let you know there's been a break, and my spirit is giving me a clue. I'm sure plenty of us have said, like, after the event, like foresight, or hindsight rather, like, wow, something told me that this wasn't right. And so that's hindsight 2020. But discernment gives you foresight 2020. So you can see before it happens, before you allow yourself to go down that unhealthy relationship, you're giving yourself that ability to have foresight 2020.
You can learn to listen to yourself and trust yourself. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue the conversation with Trillian Small, the author of Caged in Heart, Your Guide to Breaking the Cycle of Childhood Abuse. We'll be right back. Lillian, there are so many ways that children who've grown up in chaotic households learn to protect themselves. And you have created a worksheet entitled My Barriers and Defenses. Explain that worksheet to us and the elements and why that's useful.
And so you're right. One of the things that we do early on is to protect ourselves is we put a wall up. We put up barriers to prevent anybody else from causing the same or similar pain that a person did previously. And so with that worksheet, it essentially is looking at what bricks make up our wall. There are several bricks on a wall. And so it's really taking it brick by brick. What has happened in my life to cause me to put up this one brick? And so, for example, a barrier could be something that you put up. So one could be perfectionism. A part of my wall is perfectionism. And what does that do? It blocks people from seeing my vulnerable side. It blocks people from seeing, hey, I really don't have it together. But because of my perfectionism brick, you don't know that because I have that up. There's also, there's several other ones as well, but compulsive self-reliance could be a brick. It could be one of those things that you put up so that people can't come in and see that, hey, you really do have a need. You really are lonely, but because you have this barrier up that says, I'm this independent, I don't need you, then we are blocking that person from coming in. So essentially that worksheet really just helps us to look at our behaviors. What are we doing that's blocking either people from coming in, or what are we blocking people from actually seeing? And one of the things about a wall is it's great if you want to block stuff from coming in that's negative, but what about the positive stuff?
Right.
You're also blocking the positive stuff from coming in. So you have this wall up of, or this brick up that makes up your wall of, hey, I am self-reliant, I don't need you. And a person that comes by and sees that, they're like, well, you don't need me, although on the other side of the wall, you are really lonely. But because you have that brick up, you have that wall up, a person just going to pass you by because you have this facade of, I'm really okay, I'm perfect, I'm self-reliant. But truly the need that you have is, I'm lonely. So also one of those categories is, what do you need to take that brick down? What will help you remove this brick? And for a self-reliant person, it's, I really just need one person at least that I can trust that will love me for who I am. And that will begin to help you take your bricks down piece by piece. If you have a brick up of perfectionism, what do you need to take that down? Well, I just need to know if I don't finish this project, the world is not going to crumble, and it's not going to crumble if you don't. And that's essentially what that wall is. It's really for self-awareness. I created that for individuals to become more self-aware of what they actually are doing and what they need to help them if what they are doing is counterintuitive to their goals.
You have been talking about the importance of identifying the bricks, your fears, the behaviors in which you engage to keep those fears at bay, and also to identify your needs. But of course, that is one of the scariest things in the world to do for someone who has spent so much energy on protecting themselves from those fears. What was your journey to begin that particular part of the work?
My journey started when I was doing my internship at a counseling center, and it started with my supervisor. I went into that relationship with all of my walls up, and I think I probably had 20 walls. Some of them were bulletproof, and some were glass, so you can see in and see me, and then some were brick, and so I was fully armed. And the way that I started to take my wall down was she was so gentle with me, even though she saw how, and most times people will respond to a person with bricks and with walls and just reject them, like, well, that's just too much. That's just too much of a load. I'm not about to sit here and help you take all that down. And they'll leave. And that just reconfirms that's why I have my walls in the first place, because people were going to leave me anyway.
Right?
And so she really, she stuck it out with me. She recognized it's okay, Trillian. I understand. And she knew a little bit of my story, but not that much because I didn't want to share anything. Because I had this whole facade of, I'm all right, I'm perfect, I'm a superwoman. But when she, the more that she allowed me just to show up and just be, one of the things she did was a meditation. And it was just using one simple scripture that was, be still and know that I am God. And then you just take it all the way down and you just remove a word at a time. So it's be still and know that I am God. And then just be still and know. And then be still and be. And we spent so much time on that word be because she realized, I don't know how she did it, she's awesome, but she recognized I didn't know how to just be who I was. One, because I didn't know who I was. I knew who I was on my resume. I'm like, oh, yeah, this is me. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. I'm doing that. But if you asked me who I was internally, if you stripped all of that from me, I couldn't tell you who I was. And so I started this whole process of incorrect grammar, I know, but who I be, like, who am I outside of my performance? Because I thrived on performance because that is what gave me affirmation. If I knew that I was doing this and doing that and doing that, even if somebody else didn't affirm me, I could say, well, I'm doing pretty awesome for myself, even if you don't think so. And so that was one of my defenses, if you will. And it was a healthy one if you want to look at it from a perspective of, in comparison to, well, I'm going to just drink or do drugs or whatever have you. I used education and I used accolades to fulfill that void. And I learned how to just be. And people are, I love asking that question to clients of, who are you? And oftentimes their question is, I don't, like, they'll give me a, well, I'm a mom, I'm a daughter, I do this for my career, I do that. And I let them go through their whole list. And then I ask, okay, well, who are you if I take all of that away? And they oftentimes say, I don't know.
Right.
And it's the way that you learn who you are. The way that I did it was I had to ask God because I didn't know who I was. And I learned God's character and I learned who God was and I'm still learning who he is. And that has helped me because if I made in his image, then I figured that was a good place to start. Well, if I just learn about who you are, that can at least give me a starting place of learning who I am. And that was very difficult because I was a runner. I was always moving because the moment I slowed down, I started to feel, and I'm sure some of us can relate to that. We were so busy doing this and doing that, and it's a coping strategy because if I stand still long enough, what I'm running from will catch up with me, but what we fail to recognize is what we're running from is actually inside of us. That's why it always catches up with you because it's inside of you.
It never left.
And, yes. And the moment, and that's why most people have a difficult time of slowing down because they don't want themselves to catch them. And it's that child inside of you that's chasing you down saying, hey, I'm hurt, I'm wounded, I need you to listen to me. But we don't want to because it's too painful to listen to her or to him. And honestly, I would say 2 years ago, I was probably 4 years old emotionally because that child that saw the domestic violence, that child that all of a sudden didn't have a daddy anymore, she got stuck at that phase. And so I continued to grow into mature, and on the outside I looked very mature. But if anything related to a sense of rejection or not being good enough or not loved, if you trigger any of those, my response probably would revert back to a four-year-old's response. And so I want to talk to these beautiful people that are listening of how old is that inner child in you? And once you find how old she or he is, it's recognizing, and one of the ways to find out how old he or she is simply thinking about the most recent time you were very hurt, you were very angry, a very intense negative emotion, if you will, and then just asking Holy Spirit, take me back to the first time I felt this way. And 9 times out of 10, it's going to take you back to something childhood or middle school, if you allow yourself to go that far back. And then asking, what did I need in that moment? And so for me, that four-year-old needed to know I'm wanted. I just need to somebody tell me that I'm wanted. That's all I wanted. Tell me I'm wanted. Tell me that I'm good enough. And so what is your little girl, what is your little boy telling you that you often continue to avoid? Just think about a little child walking up to you now and tapping you on your leg and calling your name. They're going to keep doing it until you do what? Until you look down and say, yes, sweetheart, what is it that you need? But what we do with our own inner child is we ignore it. We're like, oh, just, you know, don't talk loud. Don't scream loud. Don't have emotions. Don't feel. Just be quiet. Just sit in the corner and be quiet. But our inner child is not. Our inner child can only be quiet for so long.
And when one allows oneself to feel the voice and hear the voice and be the voice, it's certainly the beginning of a remarkable awareness of you and who you really are.
Yes, and it can even be a love-hate relationship starting off. I had one client, I did the same activity with her, and I asked, how do you feel about your inner self, your younger child? And she was like, I hate her. And the only reason, now she loved her, the only reason why she hated her was because she was so vulnerable, because she was so needy. But when you think about it, she was six. Of course you're vulnerable. Of course you're needy. But over time, so we often can reject that part of us that was hurt because others often reject that part of us. And so we just say, you're non-significant. You're insignificant. You just stay over there. And so in the very beginning, it was hard for me to listen to my inner child because I was so used to being strong and misindependent. And the moment that even a glimpse of, oh, I do have vulnerabilities, like that scared me. And so it is a journey. It's a process, a very uncomfortable one. But at the end of the day, it's so freeing. I can't tell you how free I feel and how much at peace I feel now with my life because I allowed myself to go through all of those waves of emotions, whether they were up or whether they were down. I just knew that it was something that had to happen. And I couldn't continue to ignore her, ignore my inner self.
Trillian, one of the, there are certainly many, many books now in play about trauma and how to deal with trauma. One of the things that I notice about your book that really caused it to stand out for me is that at the end of your chapters, you provide a link for a free training video. Tell us what that's about.
For each chapter, I essentially wanted to give a little bit more resource. And so that's a little bit of my teaching side of me. I love just to give you as much information as you need. And in the videos, I provide either some activities to do or some just extra resources that will really help you take the material that you read in the chapter and begin to apply it in your life. I'm very an application-oriented person. So it's after you give me information, what am I supposed to do with this information? So essentially the videos, they're all fairly short, maybe 10 minutes or less. Some are 5 minutes. And it's an addition to the chapter, the material that you read in the chapter, to really take yourself to the next level in what you just read.
You know, it seems like a really unique and thoughtful way to round out the information that you offer in the book. How would folks find out more about you and what you're doing?
Yeah, very simple. You can find me at my website, which is www.trillionsmall.com. I'm also very social. I am on Instagram as well as Facebook and Twitter. My handles for those are at Trillian Small as well. So would love to hear from you.
And spell the name Trillian if you would.
It's T as in Tom, R-I-L-L-I-O-N, just like a million bucks, but Trillian. And last name is Small, S-M-A-L-L.
Oh, terrific. Trillian Small, thank you so much for spending time with us today. Truly has been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Pamela. It's been great with you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical or mental health or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Again, that website for today's guest is Trillion Small, T-R-I-L-L-I-O-N. S-M-A-L-L. If you do a search, you'll find all kinds of things that Trillion is doing. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that email is Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. And again, that website is mindtalk.org. You are welcome to go to the mindtalk.org website. You can also download the MindTalk app from either the iTunes or the Google Play Store. If there is anything that you would like to say or recommend for upcoming MindTalk programs, by all means, send me that email to Pamela at mindtalk.org. And folks, once again, I would like to remind you that if it's unacceptable, then that's exactly, precisely what it is. Unacceptable. You take care. Trillian.
Yes, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm awesome. How'd it go?
I think it went great. I think it went great. You know, I'm glad you think it went great. It was a wonderful interview, and I think you gave out a lot of information to folks and provided them with resources to pursue the information that